Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good afternoon, good morning, good evening, hello, and welcome back. I know it has been kind of a minute. You know, I got to brush off the cobwebs and dust here, climb back out of the rabbit hole so that I can bring you guys back down the rabbit hole with me. And in case you forgot who that is, I am, of course, the host of this show, Rachel Elaine. And with me, as always, my partner in crime and brother from another mothership, say hello to Carl Kafer, everybody.
Say hello to Carl Kafer, everyone. There, that's me. You
always
do that to me.
Oh, my God. See? I just do it so much better.
It's true.
And
I'll give you
I am super happy today. This has been something that has been on the bucket list of mine since, I don't know, probably before I was a glimmer in the milkman's eye and I was having future prophecies of amazing reading. I am super, super, super happy to welcome with us today the incredible New York Times bestselling author, Jason Pargan, nee David Wong, if you want to maybe say hello to everybody, and you can even explain some of that for us.
Hello. You're catching me on the tail end of a whole lot of interviews and publicity stuff for the new book. So if I sound mentally exhausted, that is why. This is the one time of writing is a very solitary job. And then there's this burst of a few weeks whenever the book comes out, when you talk to everyone who will talk to you. And it is a unique shifting of the gears if you have the type of personality that allows you to hold yourself up in a room and write an entire book alone, you probably are not also the type of personality that loves just talking to tons and tons of strangers every day. So it's a fascinating switch, and then I will soon have to switch back to writing mode. So
back to introvert mode. So does that mean that there's a possibility of a new Zoe Ash book in my future soonishly?
Yeah, that will be 1 year from now, October 2023, God willing. I've turned in the draft for that one. Because I am on a tight book schedule. I had this one that just came out. I've got one due next year. I've got one due the year after that I have to immediately turn around and start writing. So there's a span of time where I'm doing the uncomfortable publicity thing, talking to people, and then doing edits on the new Zoe book, and then also beginning the book after that all at the same time. I'm very bad at time management in the sense that I schedule too many things for myself.
You know, I can understand. You can ask Carl, especially since he just came back from a 10-day stay with my husband and I. I am the worst at time management, but when I do things, I do them well. It just takes me a bit.
Do you tend
so totally
to overpromise your time like I do? Do you promise people you'll get things done faster than you can actually get them done?
Yes.
That would be a yes.
All the time. As Carl is over there having an OCD twitch fest thinking about it, yes, I 100%. I think that's like the artist brain in there. It's got, extraordinary attention to detail, which you absolutely do, by the way. But there's also that disconnect. It's like, yeah, I have attention to detail, but it's attention to details that I want to focus on. Everything else can just fuck off.
Well, but it's also you want to, if you're an artist, you're any kind of creative person, you want to please people. Like, you don't like saying
exactly
no to people. You definitely don't like disappointing people. So when someone, like in my case, I've only been a full-time novelist where writing books is my only job for a couple of years. It was early 2020 when I left my day job. I mean, I've been writing novels for nearly two decades, but I've only been doing it as my only job for a couple of years now. But so there's always that fear that you don't dare say no to something for fear they'll stop asking. So like I agreed to like a more ambitious book release schedule, you know, partly for just financial reasons to make it work, but also because it's like, well, I don't want to leave people waiting too long for the next book. And so that's been my life. I create a very brutal work schedule for myself, probably worse than what a boss would create for me.
I do the same thing. I'm actually in the midst of this podcast and doing laundry all day. I'm making like 5 bouquets for a wedding this weekend because poor bride does not have a creative bone in her body and called me in tears like, I don't know how to make these flowers stick together. And I'm like, oh, shit. So, yeah, I have promised way too much of my time to way too many people because not only am I making 5 bouquets for her, I'm also altering her wedding dress. So I get you. I get you. The creative endeavors, a little Pinteresty for me this weekend, but it's as a favor for a friend, so I'm going to do it. But yeah, the fear and the disappointment of telling people no, so is like, I guess the question is that how you got into writing? I mean, I know that you've done other things in your life before you were a novelist. Like you were the executive editor of crack.com?
Yeah, I did that for about 13 years. And then before that, I got hired there in 2007 after having just run my own website, my own blog for several years. And it got popular enough that I actually put me in the pool of people who get hired for that job. But yeah, I started writing because, again, when I got out of high school, because I graduated in 1993, the Internet and the World Wide Web effectively didn't exist, not in the way it does now.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So I think we got our first internet connection in our home probably, 1995, around that era. And I just started, I had written stuff, I don't know, as a creative person as a kid, I'd written stuff just for myself and my friends, but had never like submitted to a magazine or gotten anything published or anything like that. And I had no ambitions of writing books for a living or anything. It was more just kind of a hobby. So the idea that when they invented this thing called the Internet, the World Wide Web, and very early on, you know, they had these website-making platforms like GeoCities, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
The ability to just have total control and to write whatever you want and to let that be kind of your writing school where you can just try stuff and find your voice and see what works and what doesn't, I just took to it immediately because, like, oh, this is what I've always wanted, and I didn't know I wanted it because it didn't exist, and it didn't even exist like in sci-fi. They did not have the World Wide Web in Star Trek. This was so the idea that this I'm a random guy from a very small town in the Midwest, then I can type something, and if people find it interesting enough, it can be read all around the world. It's just like, wow. This is what something I try to say to young people who feel like the job they want is one that doesn't exist. It's like, hey, it might exist in the future. The thing I wound up doing, you know, for most of my adult life was not a job when I was in high school. There's no such thing as training to, you know, have a job on the Internet because there was no such thing.
I know. And now my kids are in school and most of their classes are on the Internet, even though they're in the school building. And they're teaching kids how to do this now. And I'm like, would you say that maybe that kind of helped spark some of your interest in sci-fi? Because you're very obviously, you know, sci-fi bent with a very humorous twist. But, you know, from everything I see, well, especially the two mains, you know, you've got the J-Date series and the Zoe series. They both involve, you know, the future and space and time continuums and dimensions and crazy, wonderful shit. Did you maybe feel like you were living in the future when you started doing this writing on the Internet and stuff? Because I kind of felt like that.
Yeah, but I was a nerd long before the Internet came around. So just being just being a nerd and growing up loving that kind of thing, you know, because even, regardless if you're trying to write, you know, horror, I think most people, what they fear most is the unknown. That's ultimately what horror is about. And so in this era, as quickly as things change, most of what people fear is the future and change and what the future might look like, what their future might look like. So it's very easy to tap into that. You know, it's there are horror elements to the sci-fi novels and there's sci-fi elements to my horror novels. But ultimately, it's still going back to this very primal fear of what's in the dark, or in our case, because, again, the world changes so quickly, no one knows what the world will look like 20 years from now. And that's very scary. So it gives you a lot to play with in terms of, you know, telling stories and kind of conveying themes, that kind of thing.
Exactly.
Rachel, if I could interrupt for a second, I just wanted to also mention that, you know, we've got the horror and sci-fi and all that influence. I want to talk a little bit about how his humor started, and I want to get a little bit into PWOT, which was your blog, Pointless Waste of Time, and how that got you into Cracked, and what influenced your sense of humor, because that to me is something that really sets you apart from other authors in terms of the amalgam of humor, sci-fi, and horror that you put into all your work.
Oh, well, that's absolutely. The thing is that when people ask about like writing influences, the smart sounding answer is always quote like some great books or authors from the past, or to talk about like Lovecraft or Shirley Jackson or whatever. But for me, the honest answer is that in the late 90s, early 2000s, in that blogging scene, there was a distinct style that came about that was very kind of, it was like very smart and reference heavy, but also very like profane and kind of base. And it was very dense, I guess I would say. And like you would have long sentences that would have multiple references in the same sentence. You would have a punchline in every other sentence. So, and you would just try to pack so much into a paragraph because you were writing for an audience that had infinite free content they could look at. So there was a style that evolved from that early internet scene where it's like we are competing with free pornography for attention. We're competing with anything these people could be looking at, you know, photos or anything they could be, you know, scrolling, or they could have a chat window open back in the day, or they could be playing a game. So if you're writing long form content, you're writing a long essay or whatever, there's this very rapid, quick hitting style of like really and like escalating the joke and really kind of trying to top each other. And that it was a tremendous challenge because it's like, yeah, on one hand, the reader didn't pay anything to read this, but because they didn't pay anything to read this, their investment in it is zero. So it's very easy for them to duck out of it. In other words, if you were hired to write a long form piece for a magazine, and you knew it was going to be read by a subscriber or somebody that paid $6 or $7 for the magazine, you knew they would have a certain level of patience for the pacing or whatever of what you were writing, because it's like, well, they've already paid for the magazine. They're sitting there reading it in the doctor's office or whatever. When you're writing on the internet and you know that people are there, you're giving it away for free. They stumbled in. They don't know you most likely. And at any moment with a single mouse click, they could be looking at something much more interesting or more engaging or more outrageous or whatever. It creates this urgency in the style. So it is very like very hyperactive and kind of attention deficit style of writing that was my writing school, was just reading all of these other sites that kind of wrote in the same style and evolving. And it was obvious, it was very offensive humor in many cases, but because it was like around the South Park era and that whole attitude of like we're equal opportunity offenders or whatever. But that's where the style came from. And then when I started writing fiction in that style in the early 2000s with this because John Dice, Dan, for those unfamiliar, my first novel and the one that gave me a writing career, it was originally just a series of blog posts. I would upload another section of it every year around Halloween. And it was written in that style of, okay, this is a, you know, 150,000-word story, but I tried to write it so that every paragraph is, like, written with that same urgency. Like, at any moment, if I bore these people with three consecutive sentences, they don't care about them, they're gone. So it was
that
a style that
I
thought
love.
Was – what's that?
I said that is just something I love. You have this really frenetic pace and style to your writing that just keeps you fucking going because, like, what is this man going to do next? Like, what is going on here? I can't get over that. Every time you blow my mind.
But I can't take credit for inventing it. It's just a case where that I was exactly the right age so that right when I would start trying to write things seriously was right at the dawn of the internet, like the blogging boom, because that was, for the kids out there, long before the social media era, long before video was really a thing on the internet. It originally was all of these, you know, before Twitter, before Facebook, before all that, it was all of these bloggers, like, you know, writing articles and writing funny pieces, and that was the internet at that time. That was all the content because there wasn't really anything else to look at. Again, other than some very slow loading pornography and very low resolution.
God, pixelated nipples, Jesus Christ, those were the days.
Yes, I remember those days. Trust me.
But if I had been born 20 years later and were trying to come of age, like in the Twitter era, the TikTok era, I don't know that any of this happens. Like, I don't know that I wouldn't be out there just trying to get a YouTube show going or a podcast. You know what I mean? Because it was the fact that long form, you know, writing in that style was the thing at the time. It's definitely not the thing now. Of course, there's still people out there doing it. There's a lot of great websites and a lot of those bloggers are still working it. But it's just that I don't know if I were a young person, like my formative years, I probably would not have spent them reading blogs. I would have spent them, you know, watching YouTubers or Twitch streamers or whatever. So it's so much of like success or anything like that is due to that circumstance, because I came along right at the exact right time. Like, it was the ground floor when I started blogging. I think I've looked it up, and the internet was only in like 40% of homes at the time. We're talking about the late 90s. You know, it wouldn't get ubiquitous penetration until the early 2000s. So it's like, what a privilege that was to get in that early. Like, I was one of the early.
You absolutely did. I have to say that you came in and started publishing books at the exact right time for people of my generation. And I'm 37 now, but for people of my generation who really get that kind of acerbic, just gallows humor and even crave it at this point, because what has my entire life in the past 37 years been, but nothing but a bunch of bullshit. And so it was actually a friend of mine, a close friend of mine, that got me into the John Dies at the End series. And from there, you know, I took off, and I think it was perfect, because right at the time you started publishing these books, it was people like me and like Alex and all of my friends and exes. Like, I have made everybody I know read at least one of your books. Even my 75-year-old stepdad liked futuristic suits and fancy violence.
Yeah, and there's some things
futuristic,
like,
violence and fancy suits. Sorry, I get that.
It doesn't really make sense.
Dyslexia
the way,
tongue but sometimes.
But and there's themes in there, for example, about like these people in this small kind of rundown town that's a place that used to be like an industrial town. There's a closed factory, things like that, and how cut off from the cities and population centers they feel, like that they're so distant from where all of the people and the culture and everything is happening. Like, now that's distinctly like, oh, they're in Trump country. It's something that has become coming to focus more recently, but that's something that in the early 2000s Like I think it feels ahead of its time, but not because I am a genius, but because I just lived in one of those places. And we watched the jobs go away, and everybody who could get a college degree moved away, and everybody who couldn't stay behind, and watched everything being drained out of these places. Well, that's a cultural thing that now I think it's more like of a cultural touchstone than it was then, because now you can see many movies about that and you know, that part of the country has been ravaged by meth and opioids and all of that.
I grew up in Gravel Ridge, Arkansas, and just this last year, for the first time in my life, I moved out of Arkansas, out of the North Little Rock, Little Rock, and Gravel Ridge area. I live in Memphis now, and it is just mind-blowing what a difference it is. I mean, people in Arkansas, people in the next town over from Gravel Ridge don't know that Gravel Ridge is there. And I've taken Carl out there. It's kind of a weird little spot all on its own. And
certainly it is. I also want to just mention that I actually grew up in a town like that, a town called Bradford, Pennsylvania. We had Case knives and Zippo lighters, and we had Kendall oil. It's all gone now. Last time I was there, it was just, it's ravaged, and it's such a shame. It really is.
Yeah, and I think you would actually probably respond better to the Zoe series, Carl. I know you haven't read a bunch of his current work yet, but you will, because I have all of his books, except for the new one, waiting on that. Anyway, because it really does. It starts like that, and I personally respond really well to the female protagonist because she's not a fucking hero. She's me. She's a dumpy southern lady that really just wants to hold on to her mean cat and do her own damn thing. I have to ask you about that, Jason, because you do an exemplary job of writing from a perspective that I don't assume you have a lot of experience firsthand with. Like, how does that work?
Well, I think any writing you do, any fiction writing you do, regardless of what the genre it is, who your protagonist is, being able to understand people and why they do things is the key to any of it, because it's the same thing if you're writing the bad guy in a story, you're writing the best friend. You're obviously not going to be filling the book with a bunch of characters that are just exactly like you. And if the bad books you've read in your life, it's probably because the author tried to do just that, where they are, for example, you know, maybe they're a very educated person from, you know, a gentrified Brooklyn, and then everybody in their story talks the same way. They all have the same point of view, the same whatever. It's because they're just kind of just writing themselves over and over again for all of the different characters, where the skill that comes into writing is in observing people and trying to understand them, even people you don't necessarily like or don't agree with, but you have to be able to understand them and understand why they got the way, you know, why they got to where they did. So, for example, I used to get a lot of questions about, like, do you find it difficult to write a protagonist who's a woman? And it's like, well, it's not. Like, I find it much, much, much easier to identify with Zoe than I do with the villain in the story, the guy who calls himself Moloch, or with, you know, some of the rich jerks she meets. I can identify with her point of view much more easily than one of them. But it's not, you know, it's from observing people and trying to understand them and trying to do a lot of reading and talking to people and actually listening and understanding and trying to have empathy in the sense that everyone has a point of view and everyone has like a reason for being the way they're being. So I think the best stories are the ones where even if the protagonist or the narrator is a serial killer, you can at least come away understanding how their mind works. You don't have to like it. You certainly don't have to approve of it. And you're just trying to make it as authentic as possible. But it's, you know, again, someone else may have done a better job than me, but the core things that make Zoe who she is, the insecurities, you know, feeling like she's a fish out of water, like she's in a world that wasn't built for her. Those are things that I think to some degree every woman feels, but they're also things that every human feels. It's, you know, we're not writing for another species. It's just people who are, you know, in a little bit of a different situation.
That is like the best answer I've ever heard to that question. And I really appreciate your insight on that, because it's true. Like I've done some writing myself, and you just have to, like you said, just understand the other perspectives. And I think that's what's amazing, is because your books are full of a lot of wildly different characters. I mean, even just the characters that are reoccurring in the stories are so vastly different from each other that it's amazing. I mean, you have this entire universe of people in your head, and you don't do what George R. R. Martin does and make us try to remember 100 horrible fucking names just to get through a story. So kudos to you on that, too.
No, but at the same time, I look at someone like him, a fantasy author that writes something on that scale, and I'm as amazed as, like, people ask me, like, how do you make up a whole book? How's that? They talk about it like it's a magic trick. Well, that's how I regard what he does. There's so much and so many of the places, like, I don't know how you keep it straight in your head.
Problem, and I'm not saying he's bad at all. I respect and love what he does. It's just for people like me, sometimes that's a little confusing. When I have to keep referring back to a map in the book to figure out where I'm at, I'm like, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, Rachel, yeah, all I can tell is don't read Thomas Pynchon, whatever you do, okay?
Oh, I know. Good Lord.
What specifically are you calling out there? What does he do that is it a ton of characters that you're saying?
Thomas Pynchon, my thing on Thomas Pynchon is when I moved to New York from Bradford in the 80s, right before then I had a teacher, English teacher, who knew me pretty well and just said, you need to read this book. And it was Grotti's Rainbow. And so I started reading it, and then I found out, well, I needed a thermodynamics text. I needed an English to Italian. I needed an English to Latin. I needed various other things. I needed to get books on certain philosophers and also history of World War II. And so within 2 weeks of starting reading that in New York at the last stop on the D train, I had a whole bag of books to reference. So, yeah, I mean, there are those authors that do that. And I love that.
It's like House of Leaves all over again.
Yeah, exactly. And
here's what I've always
wondered.
I didn't mean to interrupt. Oh, I just don't, like, with his editor, does his editor know all that stuff, or is the editor just like, I'm just going to trust you on this? On all of this stuff.
I think that I'm going to trust you because nobody else writes like you. I have no clue. You know, I don't know. I think it would be one of the worst jobs in the world to be an editor to Thomas Pynchon. Though his last two novels have been less crazy. Gravity's Rainbow is over 1,000 pages. Inherent Vice was only like 300 or 250 or something like that. So he has calmed down quite a bit over the years. All right, did I go out? Are we still here?
Oh, no. Yep, I think we're still here, everybody. We were just letting you talk about Thomas Pynchon.
Yeah,
Well, that's not why we're here. We're here to talk to talk to Jason. I did want to just touch something very briefly. Most of our listeners, I would believe, are familiar with your books, but they're a little more familiar with the movie that came out, of course, in 2012, which of course was directed by Don Coscarelli. And I just wanted to ask you, what was your thoughts on the film and working with Don or how that all came about, basically?
So when John Dyson was still just a thing I was posting on my blog, after like 5 years of that, somewhere around 2005, I started selling like self-published copies of it. It's one of the services I'm sure they're much more sophisticated now, but back then it was just you uploaded a PDF and then a JPEG for the cover and sold, I don't know, a few hundred copies that way to people that didn't want to have to read it all on a monitor. Because at that point, again, it's a 150,000 word novel. That's a lot to scroll through on an old CRT PC. And then it got picked up. I was contacted by a print-on-demand publisher called Permuted Press that would do – basically, they could get a few hundred copies out into bookstores, but the big thing was it would be available on Amazon. It would have an actual ISDN number. It'd be a real book. But they didn't – like, we didn't do an edit on it or anything. It was just – it was like a nicer edition, but it was like a paperback that people could at least buy, and it was kind of expensive. But – even though only a few thousand copies of those sold, one of them wound up in the hands of Don Coscarelli, who was, for those who don't know listening to this, he's a longtime horror movie writer, director, producer, did the Phantasm movies, did Bubba Hotep back in the 80s, did Beastmaster. And he emails me out of the blue. And again, at the time, I'm running this blog. This is not my job. I'm not getting paid anything substantial to do this. I'm working at an insurance company just in a cubicle doing just entering data into insurance claims. Like, people would fill out their form and I would type it into the computer. That was it. That was my job. And I had never sold a story to anybody. I had never, you know, sold an article. I didn't make money off my writing. I was a fairly popular blogger, but that didn't mean anything. The ad revenue I made off that basically paid the hosting fees, and that was it. So then he's emailing me saying, hey, I want to buy the rights to this. Like, I need, like, who's your agent? I want to see about getting the rights to this book that you wrote to turn it to a movie. And I did not have an agent. I didn't have an editor. I didn't have really a publisher on the way you would think of it. And had to go try to find one because this was so unexpected. I at the first thought it was like a prank or like a phishing scam or something when he contacted me. I thought it was gonna be like a thing where they like wanted me to pay them to supposedly make the movie, but no, I got on the phone with him and then I had to run out and try to find, like, I hired an attorney to look at the contract because again I did not have an agent, and then sold the rights, and then kind of a couple of years passed and I didn't really hear anything, and I assumed that it just wound up on a pile of projects. And then he contacted me probably in maybe 2009 or so saying, hey, this is going into production. We have Paul Giamatti on board in a, you know, producing role and also to act in it. We've cast most of the parts. Like, we are, you know, we're doing location stuff. Like, no, this is going to happen. And then, it would have been in January 2012, I flew out to Sundance to go to the premiere and have not really had like a normal day of my life since. But it was an extremely unusual for the time because at the time, one, bloggers getting their blogs turned into actual books that were published and sold was not yet a thing. And in fact, when I started writing John Dyson, the word blog did not exist. That came along later. And the idea of a thing you wrote on the internet that became a book that became a movie, I had never heard of it ever happening even once, ever. It just, I didn't think that was a thing that, you know, of course now it's happened many times. You know, obviously Twilight and 50 Shades of Grey both, you know, got their start in like the fanfic scene. But none of that stuff existed. And like the online fiction world, there are thriving communities now that do millions of pages of stuff, you know, as we speak, but none of that was, you know, present when I started mine. So It was this extremely lucky break, because after the news got out that he had acquired the film rights, then I got the book deal from Macmillan, an imprint, St. Martin's Press, that wanted to release it in hardcover, you know, and do they acquired like the international publishing rights. And then the second, and then they signed me to do a second book in the series, and then that one became a New York Times bestseller. So all of that stemmed from Don Coscarelli stumbling across a frankly rare and extremely niche copy of this book that had become popular on the internet. But in terms of, like, if you're at a bookstore, it's not something you would stumble across. You occasionally would have the odd indie bookstore that would have it there in their horror section, and have one or two copies of it. But by long odds, he got hold of a copy, loved it, thought it fit right in with the kind of thing he does. If you've seen Bubba Hotep, you can certainly see, you know, like the parallels and the tone and everything. And then it's, you know, then had to find a way to adapt it, because it's John Dice stands the book to adapt it into, like, the entire thing into a film. That would be a $100 million movie. It's, and that's not, this was too weird. No one was going to, was no studio was going to pay that much to make a 3 hour long epic John Dies at the End movie. So I had to find a way to pare it down to do a leaner, you know, version of the story in the book. But it became a cult favorite and has played on cable and on DVD and streaming for, you know, the decades since then, and has made my book writing career. Because for every copy of a book I've sold, probably 1,000 people have seen the movie John Dies at the End. Like the number of people in the world who are familiar with my work, 99.7% have seen that movie. And then there's that tiny fraction at the bottom who have actually bought and read one of my books.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I you go.
Okay, if I could just say, Don Coscarelli is actually responsible for both you being on this podcast and also Joe Lansdale, who wrote Bubba Hotep.
Bubba Hotep, yeah.
So, and you're
is
both
currently writing me a Happ and Leonard cookbook, by the way. He's promised this more than one time. So, Joe, when you hear this show, where's my fucking cookbook?
Sorry.
Happ
and
Leonard, I don't know if it's still on Netflix, but you people listening have never watched that show, go look it up. That's the show that deserved to be a famous hit show that instead was, for me, buried at the bottom of my Netflix menus. But it has Omar from The Wire in one of the roles, the late Michael K. Williams' name. Right? But yeah, that's
it's a great
show.
Well,
Lansdale is a good friend of the podcast, and he is an amazing and wonderful writer, and that is why I know he is probably going to listen to this episode, because who doesn't want to hear another amazing and wonderful writer talk about shit? Because I think that's awesome. But for me, honestly, being such a deep fan of the book and many, many years later seeing the movie, I was so happy that the movie was made. And I was so happy that you were getting the recognition I feel like you deserve. But the movie was disappointing to me because, like you said, it was a very slimmed down version of what John Dies at the End actually is. But there is no way to put your kind of prose into a movie and really get the same sort of feeling and reaction from the way you're reading, you describing things, and, you know, the weird paradigms and riddles that you bring up when you're describing situations. There's no way to translate that to film. Now, if I were like Carl, see, Carl has other feelings. He has not read John Dies at the End, but he has seen the movie, and he fucking loves it.
Yeah, but
yeah.
That's the movie's job. The movie's job is to be a good movie, because that's the thing. If you like, if they had tasked me with writing the screenplay for the movie, it would have been a bad movie. But it would have been a treat for book readers, because the book readers would have said, oh, this is like this is like the thing that plays in my head when I read the books.
But yes, exactly.
If you're starting from scratch as from a movie and it's like, okay, this is horror, for example, horror tends to be lean. If you've seen a horror movie that's 2 hours and 40 minutes long, you probably are watching a badly paced horror movie or something that should have been
or a French one
on Netflix. But usually horror, you're keeping like the screenplay down to like 100 pages. It's people tend to not want to be like scared. And same thing with comedies. Again, I know there's such thing as 2.5 hour comedies now, but usually comedies are, you know, 90 minutes. They're lean because it's somewhat exhausting to watch a laugh a minute comedy, just as it is exhausting to sit there and be scared for 2 straight hours. So when you sit down and say,
exactly.
Okay, one, we have to, it's going to be a certain length because this is, you know, and two, knowing what we have the budget to shoot and we're having to pick, because obviously like a lot of the creature designs, intentionally silly, intentionally weird, that's great. But then there's other stuff where you would be trying to fake a location or a digital effect or things like that. For example, I've seen many other movies try to do some creature that's similar to like the Shadow People. And it never looks great. It's hard to convey what the character is seeing in the book. It's very easy to describe it in the book and ask a person to imagine
yeah.
it. Doing it on screen in a way that seems real, it seems like it's real to the characters and it's in the room with them, it's just very difficult. So as it is for a filmmaker, I think Don told me one time, you always get to shoot like 25% of what you want to shoot because you have to make these heartbreaking decisions one after another after another, because it is very easy for me to say, and then he blinked his eyes and suddenly he was standing on a mountaintop.
Right.
And if you're the filmmaker, you're like, well, okay, can we shoot on a mountaintop? How do you get the equipment there? Where do you what mountains allow you to shoot? Can we travel there? Like, they have to actually make the practical decisions. And then what happens is 3 out of every 4 things you would love, like you can imagine that you would love to put it in there, you have to kill it. And so you've got to put together a movie that – and the fact that, to be clear, people – love this movie. I only have a book writing career because people love this movie. Lots of people sell film rights to books or TV rights. Lots of people, a much smaller percentage, do get the thing made into a movie or a TV show. The reason I have a book writing career is because it, A, got adapted into a movie, B, the movie got made, and C, people love the movie. And every time the movie plays on Hulu or Showtime or Netflix or wherever it is now, Amazon Prime, I think right now it's up for free if you're a Prime member, somebody goes out and buys the book. And I will presumably have royalties checks coming in for book sales for as long as that movie plays. So like if you say, well, yeah, but don't you wish there were some big budget 10-hour long version like a big budget Netflix series like Stranger Things, where they spend $30 million an episode. It's like, well, sure. But the moment they agree to write that check, they're going to have lots of suggestions for what they want changed. They're going to want a PG-13
exactly.
version. And so if you want it to be as weird as this was and you want it to be allowed, then you're also agreeing, you know, unless you're one of the exclusive few people in the world who get giant budgets to do truly weird stuff, then you're saying, okay, we're going to do it on way less money, but we're going to get to make it as weird as we can. And that's the trade-off that most people are happy to make. But yeah, I'm not saying that someday it may be a streaming series someday. The rights are still out there. Somebody could decide, hey, it's time to do this, to do 8 hours on one of the whatever, Shudder, name a streaming service, Tubi.
Any of them. No, and I want you to understand, I was not denigrating the movie at all, like at all. As a movie itself, it's fantastic. And this podcast is in association with the Incredibly Strange Films Facebook group and also Film and Stuff. And so a lot of people that are going to be listening to this are going to be listening to it because they know you from the movie. But our other sister group, Incredibly Strange Literature is also going to be listening to this because, well, I mean, obviously you come up on there a lot. So, the movie is not bad at all, but there's still that little, like, piece of me that's like, oh, you know, they could never, because I knew reading it, like, I would love to see it on the screen, but there was never any way that they were going to be able to do it justice with just a movie. Like, it's too complex for that. And I think that for what they did a great job. And I love hearing you confirm that, yes, like having people watch this movie and talk about it constantly is keeping you in the green. So I am super stoked about that. But, yeah, personally, I was one of those people that was like, I like the movie, but I like the book way better. I guess, does that make any sense?
Well, I think writers that are disappointed in the film adaptations, and there are some who just, you know, like openly get angry sometimes about, I know that Stephen King has made fun of some of the movies that got made from his books. I think because as a writer, so much of what you're proud of is your language. It's the description, how I describe the room, how I describe this weird restaurant they're in. And it's like all that's lost. Because even if the movie has narration, which, by the way, everybody hates, even if it has voiceover, it's not going to describe the character's outfit. And it's like, well, I did such a great job describing his whimsical outfit. It's like, well, yeah, but now it's up to a costume person to make it, and you're, it's like, yeah, but my precious words, I had such a great turn of phrase describing this guy's mustache. It's like, well, yeah, but now it's up to the wig and makeup person to put that mustache on him. It's your words are lost. And so, like, part of the joy in watching this, you know, I saw it at Sundance, and I'm sitting there with the cast. Like, there are scenes where I know I spent an entire page describing what was going through the main characters through David's mind while he's watching this thing occur. I've got, you know, hundreds of words in paragraph after paragraph going through his, you know, the various stages of his emotions and what he's thinking and what he's observing. And I'm watching it, and Chase Williamson just has to do all of that with his face. Like, he has to convey just with one expression that lasts for 3 seconds and, like, you know, 600 frames or 300 frames or whatever, or I don't know how many frames there are in a second film, I'm sorry. He has to, like, convey all of this emotions going through and this entire reaction, and that is its own art. That is just as valid an art form as all of this writing that I did that I was so wanted to impress people with. And it's like, oh, this is theirs. This cast and crew, like, this movie belongs to them, because what he just had to do there, having to convey all of that into a nonverbal expression, it's like, no, they deserve the credit for this. I deserve credit for the book, that this is their thing. I can't imagine being the type of writer who would then sit down and watch an adaptation and just spend the whole time being mad at it, because it's just so much harder. It's so much harder. Like, I can sit there and describe anything I want. These people actually have to go out and procure those things, and they have to find a location that matches. In my time at Cracked, I had some limited involvement in the video stuff, and knowing the effort that goes into making like a 3-minute video, it's like, my God, it's such a pain in the ass. This is why I've never aspired to like work in Hollywood. It's a nightmare. It's so much harder.
Oh, and that is something we talk to a lot of our guests about. A lot of our guests are actually directors and screenwriters for more like micro budget or first time productions and stuff. But we do have a few bigger names that we've talked to, and they all say the same thing. Like, most of the time, the people that we talk to when they're doing these micro budget productions, it's because they don't want to deal with Hollywood. They're like, we don't have to deal with Hollywood. We just make like our vision come true, and it's awesome. But it's so, so difficult. I mean, one of our best friends and other podcast partners in the network, Vicky Love, she's shooting her first film right now, and we've been interviewing her about that for the past year, and it's just ridiculous the thing that things that she's had to go through, especially shooting a film like during and post COVID and safely. Like, wow. I do not envy anybody that has to do any of that. I'm much more on your spectrum of things. Like, let me sit behind my computer screen and just write a bunch of shit and keep away from people.
I think the average person, especially the average person who, like, criticizes movies on the internet, like they have YouTube shows doing movie reviews, I think they don't have any clue how much the storytelling, especially on low-budget film, is dictated by what's physically possible. For example, in many, many, many cases, they'll be like, well, why is it, you know, this character, I thought in the early scenes, I thought they were going to be a big deal, and then they kind of disappear in the whole third act. It's like, well, that actor, they got a different job, and they had to leave. They weren't in town anymore. It's like, why didn't you, why didn't you go back and shoot the finale in that cool factory? Why'd you shoot it in that guy's farm? It's like, yeah, we didn't have access to the factory that day. We couldn't shoot there. We wanted to, but the weather washed us out. And then they, it was being used by somebody else. It's like all of these practical things. When someone imagines, if I could make a movie, I would finally make one that's good. It's like, boy, even the movies you complain about, like the Marvel movies and stuff that cost $200 million, the sheer logistics of putting that stuff together and the sheer logistics of how difficult it is for actors to act when you shot their scenes together, the actors were actually separate because neither one of them were on set that day. So they both did it in front of a blue screen, and then the effects team had to stitch it together, and people watch it and you complain about the performance. It's like, yeah, but you understand that, like, Chris Evans delivered those lines to a tennis ball on a stick.
And right.
Like everyone's trying to overcome all of these logistical things because it's so, even at that scale, there's so many moving parts and there's so many staff and so many different departments. You've got special effects companies in five different countries around the world you're communicating with and trying to get them all on the same page, and people like, why that creature looked fake? It's like, yeah, these people were working 20 hours a day trying to get that thing done in time for release, and they did their best.
Oh, one of my favorite horror movies of, what was it, last year, Carl? Now, this is Austin Allen James. Are You With Me?
Yeah.
That's the name of the movie. Who's With Me, maybe. Anyway, one of our favorite horror movies, both Carl and mine, was from a first-time director, and it's a kind of a short film. And we found out later that the entire film, they were trying to be COVID safe while filming this. So there was not a single actor in the film, although there was only two that we really know of. There was not a single actor in the film that was in the same room with one another while filming. I mean, this guy's literally talking to a wall the entire time. And then this other girl who records from behind the wall, you know, she did her scenes in a completely separate area, and she's doing it from behind a wall, just, you know, basically talking to a wall. And when they put it all together, it was beautiful and compelling and wonderful. But, man, we had a whole hour and a half discussion just on the logistics of trying to film a COVID-safe movie on an almost non-existent budget.
Did that film for less than $3,000.
Yeah,
he did. Yeah, and that's, I worry people have not tried to do like any kind of theater or anything like that. The difficulty in doing a scene like that when you don't have the other actor to work off of and to bounce off of and to like match their energy or whatever, and you have to just trust that when they do their half of the scene, it's going to, and then when the director has to sit down in the editing bay with all of this that they shot and you're trying to piece it together and make a coherent scene out of it. And you're like all the little choices get made in editing where you will cheat by grabbing a reaction shot from a different part of the conversation, inserting it here to make it look like she's reacting to this line. I don't think people realize how much of the writing of a movie occurs in the editing bay because you're constructing, because a lot of times the stuff you shot, a lot of it didn't work, but you don't have clean audio or something. I mean, you had, you know, a continuity problem with the costumes or something like that. all these little things you have to worry about. And then if you're shooting, like you said, they shot for $3,000, that means you've got a lot of people basically helping you in their spare time, probably for free, right? But that means you're working around their schedules. So I think when you talk about all of these people who, like Quentin Tarantino, you know, his first movie was one he just shot over the course of years with his own equipment, with his friends or whatever. But that's all based on availability. It's all based on when people, they're not working that weekend, or they're willing to sacrifice their weekend, or your main actor halfway through the production, he gets married and has a kid and doesn't want to act anymore. Like, it is a miracle that anything gets made, because it takes so much. It takes so many people. And the fact that now that they're not having to buy $10,000 worth of film, of 8mm or whatever they shoot on, that they can just, you know, that anyone can afford a digital camera that'll get you decent looking footage. Like, that's a miracle. It did not used to be like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's what's so fun about things right now, is that it's getting to a point where people can do more of these indie projects. I mean, frankly, John Dies at the End was an indie project. And it has become what it is now, but it's still, from what I can tell, a generally you-based kind of still indie thing. And now that anybody can afford these cameras and this equipment, maybe there's hope that we'll find a way to put things onto the screen that do an even better job of depicting your craft. Like I said, the movie was not bad. It's a great movie, but the book is just so much more. I can't even describe anything without giving any spoilers away. So pretty much I just want everybody to go watch the movie first and then go buy all the books, because you're going to want to.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm going to interrupt here just for a moment, just to let you know that we're nearing the hour, so if we want to decide to wrap this up with Jason, that's probably, you know, or if we want to go further.
It's up to you guys. I don't, like I said, I didn't schedule anything at 4 Eastern. It's if there's something we haven't gotten to yet, then that's fine. Go ahead and.
Okay. Rachel, go ahead.
Honestly, the only thing I have to ask beyond all of this is, of course, I have not read the new book, and of course, Carl has not read the new book, and like you said, a lot of us out there haven't read the new book. Could we maybe get like a little brief disclosure on that? I know it's the fourth in the John Dies at the End series.
It is the fourth in the series, but they're not serialized. These are episodic. You can read. If people out there for some reason want to jump into the series with book four, you actually can. You can read any of them independently. They're not like the books don't end on a cliffhanger, and then you have to read the next one to find out what happens. They're complete stories. This one is called If This Book Exists, You're in the Wrong Universe. It has a bright neon green cover. But basically the format of these novels, each of them, is that at the start, it appears to be a very straightforward horror scenario. The first one starts out with they're just going to what they think is a haunted house. The second one starts out, a guy finds a little monster in his home. And then as they go, there's 700 or 800 twists along the way, and it winds up very, very, very far away from where you started. And I noticed that, like, the TV show Rick and Morty does this. They tend to take some well-worn, like, science fiction trope, and then by the end of the episode, you've wound up somewhere very, very far away from that. So this one starts with what it's something that you've seen many times, with what someone complains they have a toy that is haunted or that is acting weird, that is possessed, and what seems like a fairly straightforward thing. Well, that's fine. You just got to just throw it away, or because usually when they run across one of these, they will either get rid of it or they'll try to just sell it. If it doesn't seem too dangerous, they'll sell it on Craigslist or something. But you know, if you've read the previous three books, it starts there. And then I'm not going to spoil anything that happens, but it very quickly, you go down a rabbit hole, I guess, like the name of the show, And that's kind of the fun of these, is that they go off the rails very, very quickly. But that's why, if you've seen the promotional materials or you've seen the cover of the book, there's like this iconography of this little polka dotted egg. It's a little egg toy that promises there's like a little stuffed animal in it that will pop out. And from there, a whole bunch of just truly horrible and stupid things ensue.
And I will say that I love your penchant for being able to absolutely and wordlessly, using your words, but not those exact words, make the title of every single one of your books make perfect sense, but in a really fucked up way.
Yeah, I try. It's and a lot of thought goes into the titles. It's but yeah, without spoiling anything, they are supposed to be like eye catching or whatever. You see it on the shelf, and they do, once you've read it, it actually does make sense.
It makes perfect sense, but not in a way that you ever could have expected.
Yeah, ideally.
So, yes, that is one of my favorite things of all, right there. So what are some good ways that people can get connected with you? What's the best way to, like, buy your books and make sure that all the proceeds go to you and not the evil corporations? Like, how do we do all that?
I can never be too particular with how people buy it, whatever is the cheapest way to get it. If you want the audiobook, that's only at Audible or at Amazon, which Audible is owned by Amazon, you probably know. Otherwise, it's available at any. They'll have copies at Barnes Noble. Any decent bookstore in your neighborhood should have it. It's out in hardcover, ebook, audio. Again, the title is If This Book Exists, You're in the Wrong Universe. If you're worried about like what method of buying that helps me the most, please don't worry about that. If you have an independent bookstore you can support, get it there. It may be a couple dollars more than what it would cost at Amazon, but a lot of bookstores, a lot of brick and mortar bookstores died in the pandemic and never came back. We lost.
I know.
Many, many, many stores and the chains that exist. Like once upon a time, I used to think of Barnes & Noble as like the megalith that's like eating up all of the little bookstores. And it's like, well, now, Jesus, Barnes & Noble is the last one left. It's like that's the next best thing. Get it off the shelf at a Barnes & Noble. Keep your Barnes & Noble open because we need a variety of places to buy books. Let me phrase it that way.
Yes,
there needs
we do.
To be competition.
And
it can't get where there's only one place where they all come from, if you know what I'm saying.
Absolutely. I am so excited that now I live in a different city, because every single independent bookshop in my area, my county even, in Arkansas, closed. Every single one of them. And the Barnes & Nobles we had out there weren't that great. But now I'm in Memphis, and I have a couple of local sellers that I can go to, so I'm actually going to call one of them today and see if I can get my copy of the new book. Yay! So, yes, I agree 100%. Support your local booksellers if you have any available. If not, you can go online. You can even type in independent booksellers, and they will gladly ship you things from all over the country. That's why I have all of my Neil Gaiman coloring books. We didn't have independent bookstores in Arkansas, but I found some online and they sent it to me anyway. So do what you can to keep booksellers open. And if not, support your local libraries too. Make sure that they get copies of these books for people to read.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So at this point,
beyond
that,
yeah, I was going to say, Carl, I think it's probably time for you to knock on the door and do some housekeeping. If you can stick around with us for just another second, Mr. Jason, this will only take a second, and then we'll be on our way out.
Actually, to be honest, there really isn't doing much. We did so much over October once I got back from vacation. that I've done now, I think, 9 shows in 8 days. So it's a wonderful thing. But I do want to just say that on Saturday, Eric, otherwise a.k.a. Doc Sludge, and I will be doing a commentary watch on the Manchurian Candidate in honor of the recent passing of Angela Lansbury. So we'll be doing that on Saturday. We also have on the 11th, we have Cathode Ray Mission, which is Adam Ferenz, and they're going to be doing a episode on Frobenhuysen, otherwise known as The Killing, a Danish TV series that ran for 3 seasons. We have some upcoming shows that I can't really say yet. I do know that I have a message from Scott Goldenberg, who directed Forest Hills, that I have to reply to. And hopefully we'll have that set up. And if you don't know anything about that, this film marks the return to the screen of Shelley Duvall for over 2 decades. So it's something that I'm really interested in, having fallen in love with her in the 70s when I was young. So hopefully we'll get that all set up. And that's what we have right now. What I can tell you in the future, that we're going to be doing a lot of Turkey movies, you know, movies so bad that we make you watch them with us. And we'll be doing some commentary watches on that. I'll also be working with my former podcast partner, Stephen Ronquillo, on his network, which is KSDAD. We'll have lots going on, but right now that's all we have, Rachel. All right, I'm done. Go ahead.
Did she step away?
She did. It looks like she got what we like to call raptured. So it's only you and me. Jason, I want to thank you very, very much for being on with us.
Thanks for having me.
Really appreciate it. Oh, absolutely. And good luck with the new novel and everything that you have planned. And feel free to come back when you have something else ready to go. And here's Rachel. She's back. So hold on. Rachel, are you with us?
No, this is Pastor Don, GNCEO. How you doing today, sir?
We're done with our show, sir. So thank you very much.
Bye.
Okay, Jason, thank you very much for being with us. And we'll talk to you later, all right? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Say good night, everyone. Good night, good afternoon, whatever it is. Thank you for joining us. Okay, bye.